This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
And that brings us back once again to 1 Corinthians
chapter 9,
a passage about giving up our rights for the sake of others. Rights and freedoms that we have and that we can legitimately claim, but which we voluntarily decide to give up for the good of another. It's a concept that's rolled up in this whole notion of self-sacrificial love. The context for this passage is chapter 8. It had to do with this kind of esoteric discussion about whether to eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols. And some of the people were from a religious background that made that offensive to them. Others were maybe tempted that if we're going to eat the meat sacrificed to idols, what's wrong with a little bit of idol worship? And so Paul had put forth the assertion to the Christians there, maybe you ought to consider whether you should give up your right to eat this meat sacrificed to idols. He says, you know, technically you have the right to eat it. There's nothing wrong with it. It's not spiritually dangerous. But he says, maybe you should give that right up, particularly if it's going to cause a problem with a weaker brother. At least when they're around, you should give it up. And that concept then, which doesn't directly apply to us in the sense of the meat sacrificed to idols, but does apply to us in a range of other cases that we discuss, typical types of situations. At an even deeper level, it goes to the root of what was missing in this church. A point that we've seen over and over again in this book, that this group was living based on the self-first thesis. They did not understand what self-giving love was, and so they were really missing the point in a big way when it came to Christian living. Now, let's read through this and see if we can follow his argument, because what he's going to do is he's saying, I've given you the principle, but now I want to illustrate it. He says, I'm going to show you that I basically do this. You know, he's saying, I'm not asking you to do anything that I wouldn't do. And so he's going to give them an example from his life, one that they're familiar with, where he has done the very thing that he's asking them to do. He says in verse 1, am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are not you my work in the Lord? If to others I'm not an apostle, at least I am to you, because you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. Well, an apostle is a sent one, a missionary, somebody who's sent out to plant new churches. And Paul was sent out. He did plant churches, including the one that he's writing to, the city of Corinth. That was the church that he started. So he says, some people might say, I'm not an apostle. You guys can't really say that because you know personally that I am an apostle and that I did plant that church there. So he's establishing his credentials because this is going to have to do with the argument that he's going to make. And you see, he not only says he's an apostle, but also that he was an eyewitness to the resurrected Christ. It's clear in the New Testament there are the 12 apostles that Christ chose, but then there are other apostles. And apostleship is listed as one of the spiritual gifts we'll see in chapter 12. In fact, we can identify a number of other apostles in the New Testament, including apparently some people who were not around when Jesus walked. And even as late as the book of Revelation, written in the 90s AD, in chapter 2, he still commends the Ephesian church because he says some of the people who came to you and said they were apostles, you tested them and found out they weren't. He says that's a good job. Well, at the time this was written, John was the only living apostle in the world at that time of the original one. So it's clear, point I'm making is, that apostleship was, they were the original apostles and they were special, but then there were other apostles, and the word apostolos means somebody who is sent out, missionaries. Same, identical to our concept of a missionary. However, when he says, did I not see Jesus? Paul was an eyewitness of Christ after the resurrection. And that does seem to be a special credential which the original apostles had alone. No one else can claim to have had this. And because of that, they were authorized to literally write authoritative scripture. Something that If somebody was a missionary or an apostle today, they would not be able to do that, but they could. He says, my defense to those who examine me is this. Do we not have a right to eat and drink? Yeah, they do. Do we not have the right to take along a believing wife on our journeys, even like the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Yeah, nothing wrong with that. He definitely has that right. So these are rights that he has, but he has not taken advantage of them. He says, or do only Barnabas and I not have a right to refrain from working with our hands? We read that Paul would sew tents, and this great world-class scholar spent half of his time sewing tents, something anyone could do, so that he could earn money. That way he didn't have to take offerings from the people he was speaking to, and he could pay his own way. And he's saying, I have the right to be paid, but me and Barnabas, we work and serve at our own expense. Who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Well, that's pretty unheard of. If you enlist in the army, then you're paid by the government. You don't have to earn your own wage in addition to being a soldier. Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Nobody. Who tends a flock and does not use some of the milk of the flock? Nobody. These are all pretty reasonable analogies. And what he's basically heading toward is, I am a top qualified apostle, which is like the highest office in the church. I successfully planted the church like yours in Corinth. I am entitled as such to be paid for my work, just like you would pay anyone for their work. And I have not taken advantage of that. He says, look, what does it say in the law? You shall not muzzle the ox while he is threshing. Put on a muzzle. If you were greedy and you had your ox pulling the wheel around when you were crushing the grain to get it out of the pods and stuff, then you didn't want the ox to just eat a little bit of the grain while he was threshing. And so there's a law in the Old Testament that you're not allowed to put a muzzle on the ox and prevent him from eating some of that grain. Because after all, that would be mean. That'd be mean to the cow. Just to see all this grain and not be able to figure out how to eat it. It's inhumane. That's why the law is there. And he says, that applies, in fact, to Christian workers as well. He says, God's not concerned about oxen, is he? Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? In a sense, yes, he is. Because what God's main concern, this is an interesting hermeneutical question, we don't have time to really unpack this, but was God referring to oxen or to first century Christian workers? He was referring to the humans involved, and the reason for the law, interestingly, was not for the ox, but God gave the law for the people, because if they were permitted to behave in an unkind and inhumane way to animals, that would give them a hardened heart. And so this is the point he's making. Anyway, he says, the point, though, for us is that the plowman ought to plow in hope, the thresher ought to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. If we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we should reap material things from you? Is that asking too much? It is not. That is a legitimate right, in fact, that he has. He says, if others share the right over you, do we not far more? They were paying some of their local pastors there, apparently. And he refers to this later in 2 Corinthians. But Paul, the one who was like the top guy, received nothing from the group. He says, nevertheless, we did not make use of this right, but we endure all things that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. Apparently, at one point in time, while Paul was in Corinth, and it sounds like it was pretty early on, someone in Corinth charged that Paul was in it for the money. And they had sophists, traveling speakers and wise men, preachers and whatnot, who would come in and give speeches for a fee. And actually, in Greece, which is where Corinth is, people could make a pretty good living. If you were a good speaker, people would pay to hear speeches and stuff. So people were automatically suspicious anytime somebody you know, came into town and started to speak, give speeches. It's another one of these guys that's basically trying to make money. And they accused him of that. Paul turned in public and responded, "I will never again take a dollar, a denarius, or what have you, from anyone in the city of Corinth." So to hush this accusation, to refute it once and for all, he says, "I'll never accept a penny from anyone in this city." It's something that Paul did once in a while, when anytime somebody would have accused his integrity or his motives, he would take this stand. Paul was not against taking money for ministry. He would do that. We'll see the story in a minute. He says, "Do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the food of the temple?" That is the priests, who we talked about before, how the priests, when you brought an animal sacrifice in, the priests got part of that meat as a payment in kind. "Those who attend regularly to the altar have their share with the altar. So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel." Yes, Jesus did say that. Jesus, quote, "The laborer is worthy of his hire," unquote, referring to Christian workers. They should be paid. If they're going beyond the time they can do as a volunteer, then they should be paid for that. Verse 15, he says, "I have used none of these things." And so here is the example of him not using rights that he has. "And I'm not writing these things so that it may be done so in my case, and I still don't want to use the right. For it would be better for me to die than to have any man make my boast an empty one. For if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for I'm under compulsion. For woe is me if I do not preach the gospel." That's kind of an interesting verse, isn't it? So he's saying, I can't really take credit for preaching the gospel because I'm basically being forced to do this. I'm compelled. And it's an interesting sentiment that I can kind of identify with. A lot of people have talked to me and said, I kind of feel this way as well. I feel like it's something I have to do. I couldn't stop if I tried. Anyway, if I do this voluntarily, then I have a reward. But if against my will, it's just a stewardship. When God gives you gifts, you feel a strong compulsion to use them. In 18, he says, "What then is my reward? That when I preach the gospel, I may offer the gospel without charge so as to not to make full use of my right in the gospel." And he says, that makes me feel good that I am able to preach and plant the church there, and yet you guys never paid me anything. He says, you got to think about that. Here's the story, Acts 18. This is when Paul was in the city of Corinth. We have the history in the book of Acts of the planting of this church. We read after this that Paul left Athens and he went to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. That ordering of the Jews to leave Rome by Claudius is recorded in secular history, by the way. This is confirmed exactly as he's telling it here. Anyway, Paul went to see them, and because he was a tent maker, as they were, he stayed and worked with them. And so Aquila, Priscilla, and Paul set up a business and started making tents. He was from the city of Tarsus, which was famous in the ancient world for their red leather tents that they made. You know, tents, people would actually live in their tents in those days. And so they would make some tents out of leather. Nice tent. Corinthian leather. That's what these tents were. So here they are, sewing tents. Every Sabbath, then, he would go down and reason in the synagogue trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. So he was doing both, working and preaching. Then we read, when Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. When Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia would be the north, what today, northern Greece, Or even there's a little area that's still a country of Macedonia there. One of the cities in northern Greece, Macedonia, at that time, the province of Macedonia, was the little Greek city of Philippi. We have the book of Philippians written to them. And they had a vigorous young body of Christ growing there. They often sent gifts of money to support Paul. And that's where they came from. And they came down with a purse full of money. If you read Philippians chapter 4, he reminds the Philippians how at the first time I came through Greece and preached the gospel, you were the only church that shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving. And more than once, he says, you sent me a gift for my needs. So from that particular group, he was willing to accept financial support because they had a good attitude about it. But from the others, most of them apparently, and in Greece at least, he did not. We have the example in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. This is another city in modern day Greece, Thessalonica. And he reminds them, he says, you remember when we were there, you know you ought to follow our example because we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it. But with labor and hardship, we kept working night and day so that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we don't have the right to do this. Again, we have the right to say, where's our pay? But we do it in order to offer ourselves as a model for you that you might follow our example. So if you can imagine having Paul over to dinner at your house, and before sitting down at the table, he reaches in and pulls out a $10 bill and hands it to you. And you'd be like, what? What? You're our guest tonight. We're not going to take that. Well, I'm afraid you're going to have to take it, you know, under the circumstances, or I'll have to leave. That's what it would have been like. He would not even sit down and eat any bread unless you agreed to let him pay for it. That's how stringent he was when he would tell people, I'm not going to accept any money from anyone in this city. It not only included cash, but also even bread. Wouldn't even accept bread without paying for it. Imagine that. This guy was really tough, very hard line, full of integrity, though. You have to admire somebody who's going to put themselves to that much extra hardship, even when maybe 80 or 90% of the people had a good attitude and would have gladly supported him. A small minority were suspicious and broadcasting their suspicions, but for their sake, he would take nothing from anyone and would work teaching, work all day making tents and go out and teach at night. Cool, I think. Wish we had more so-called men of God like this around today. Not too many that suffer from this malady of being too principled. But you can see that, you know, if that suspicion gets out in a town that this guy's pocketing the cash, and then you let that spread and whatnot, that could spread cynicism, and some people who might be inclined to listen would have the perfect excuse to say, oh, he's one of those, and not even hear the message. Paul was not going to risk that danger. He cared too much about people to let something as inconsequential as money interfere with the possibility of someone hearing the gospel, the good news of Christ. Man, that's far out. He says, for though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, that I may win the more. To the Jews, I'm like a Jew, that I may win Jews. He says, well, Paul was a Jew. But he says, when I'm with the Jews, I know how to act like a Jew. See, he would go into these synagogues. When he went in there, he'd wear his blue tonsured robe that signified that he was a rabbi from Jerusalem, a top flight rabbi. When someone like that walked into one of these foreign Jewish synagogues, they'd be like, whoa, you know, this is like having Professor so-and-so's here with us. Why don't you teach us the Torah this week? And he'd be like, I'd be happy to, and gets up and he says, look, let's read Isaiah 53 or whatever, you know. He says, I know how to act like a Jew when I'm with the Jews. And I do that. He says, to those who are under the law, I act like I'm under the law, even though we know that Paul was not under the law. He says, I'm not under the law. He says, we read in chapter 8, he says, you can eat, for instance, that meat sacrificed to idols. It doesn't do any harm. That's not what the people under law thought. But when he was with the people under law, he knew how to accept the same restrictions on himself that they had so that he could identify with them. To those who are without law, he says, I'm as though I'm without law. And yet we can see from this passage that he was under the law of Christ. Christ says, a new command I bring to you, that you love one another as I have loved you. And greater love has no man than that he give up his life for his brothers. And so we see that Paul had the amazing freedom to be able to say, all things are lawful. We read that verse. And yet he says, not all things edify, not everything builds others up. So we give up some of our freedom voluntarily because we care about the people around us. That's the law of Christ. He says, to the weak, I become a weak person so I can win the weak. Paul never had a weak day in his life. If there's any adjective that could be further from a description of this guy, it would be a weakling. But the thing is, you know, he knew how to identify with people that were struggling, and he knew how to get on their level and be empathetic with that. I have become all things to all men, that I may by all means save some. So we see that he did live a life of self-sacrifice for the sake. Now, of course, some of the assumptions behind this. First of all, one assumption is that God is real, that he exists, that he's not just our hopeful thinking, or a belief that we have that makes us feel good, but that there in fact really is a God there, Creator God, who made the world. Another assumption is that most people don't know God, and they need to know more about him. They need to know what he has done, coming to earth in the person of Christ, dying to pay for people's sins, making it possible to reestablish direct relationship with him. This is what he calls the gospel, the good news. Is that we don't have to work our way up to God. We don't have to be righteous people. All we have to do is accept the free gift of eternal life and tell God, you know, I accept this gift and I want the death of Christ to apply to me. And that opens the doors then to that direct personal relationship with God. You have to realize these are all the assumptions. This is what he's thinking that makes sense of this entire passage. None of it would make sense if you didn't have those underlying assumptions. Why is he worrying about going over to Greece to save people? It's because God is actually there. It's real. That's why. It's because it's not just his opinion and his personal religious view and their personal religious view. It's the literal truth out there, apart from what our view is. And that's why he's prepared to sacrifice himself for it. This whole passage then, giving up rights that you have to further the cause of God in this world, to help people come to know the Lord, this is a crucial area of sacrificial love for all Christians, not just for apostles, traveling apostles. But in fact, the principle here that he is arguing, the example that he's giving of his life, applies to all people. And that is a practice that we could call contextualization. That's the fancy modern word that people have come up with for this. Contextualization meaning that when we relate to any particular culture and try to explain what, you know, God's way to them, that we do it in their cultural language and in their cultural context. We don't call them out of their context into our context to hear this message, but it's for us to deny our native context and to go out into and become a part of their context. And that's the situation in which people can hear what we're saying. That's what Paul was doing here. If the context was people who were suspicious of traveling speakers being in it for the money, then the conclusion was clear, that you don't take any money under those circumstances. And that everyone knows, you know, you can't even get Paul to take a piece of bread, anything. And that way, he is contextualizing the gospel to that particular situation. You know, we used to do that here for years. Zenos had no staff at all. And no budget. We didn't even have a bank account. For over a decade, our church was here and we planted house churches. We grew, multiplied. This church was approaching Well, we certainly had hundreds of members, and I think it was we were approaching 1,000 people in the church before we ever hired our first staffer, yours truly. And me and Gary were hired after a very tough discussion one night with the leadership, the 80 leaders of home churches at the time, and they pressed us very hard that we needed to forget about our home decoration business and get rid of it and go to work for the fellowship, that the church was too large to be without employees at that point. And it was very, very difficult for us because, for one thing, we had poured years of work into this business that we had built up. And neither one of us felt very excited about giving it up. And I had always read these things like that Paul had here, and I always thought, you know, that's cool. That's where it's at. And that's why I just felt like I'm just going to do that. And so during that first decade and more, it was 12 years of Zenos existence, with nobody working professionally, no one on staff, everyone in the church was a tent maker. Everyone. Today, still, most of us are tent makers. Most of you who serve God, teach, lead home groups, and you're tent makers. You're not being paid anything. Now we have a staff which is supposed to help you and make that easier for you to do. Anyway, I'm getting off the subject here. The subject is contextualization. The subject is a very important one, and it's one that's been neglected and misunderstood by the church to our ruin, to great harm to the cause of Christ, namely that the church should not permit itself to break away from the cultural context in which it's supposed to give out its message. There shouldn't be one culture for the local people and a different culture for church people. That should never happen. Not because cultures don't change, because they do, but because the church is willing to change with them, no matter what that cost might be. That's why. We're basically saying Jesus doesn't wear any cultural label, but that Christianity is truly a universal faith and it fits beautifully into all cultures. What we have instead in the modern West today is what could be called anti-cultural fundamentalism, where in fundamental Christianity there has been a reaction against the culture of today. And it's really a reaction in favor of a culture from yesterday, or from maybe 100 years ago. And they're feeling it will be, that was a good culture. But this today, we hate this, and this is wicked too. So they will lock on to one culture and refuse to adapt and change to other succeeding cultural changes and mutations that happen. And they hate to come eventually to hate the culture of which they're a part. And the features and aspects of culture that are hated by the anti-cultural fundamentalist. When I went to Brazil to visit, sometimes it's easier to understand this when we'll talk about America in a minute, but sometimes it's easier to understand this when you see it happening in another culture, not our own. When I went to Brazil many years ago to the Amazonian region to visit Christians there, I was appalled at the level of poverty in this area. We were in a city of 250,000 that was unbelievably poor. Even the rich people there would have been considered very poor here. And people were living in hovels. Nobody had anything. Even in the stores, you couldn't hardly buy anything. There was just no money in this city. And yet, right in the center of the city, they had a really quite large soccer stadium. You know, it looked like the horseshoe down here. I mean, it was that kind of thing. It was way bigger than any other building in town. They didn't have any high rises in this city or anything like that. Just this one, you know, it was all hovels and a big soccer stadium in the middle. You could tell these people really like soccer. Everywhere you went, you know, vacant fields and stuff, they would be swarming with kids playing soccer. And stuff. Everybody played soccer all the time. And that's the way it is in that culture. We were amazed and astonished to go into the Christian churches we were visiting and discover that they had a rule against Christians playing or going to soccer games. If you can believe that, the biggest thing happening in that culture. And we were like, what? Because they said that one guy had been kicked out of their church because he was going and playing soccer again. Kicked out a guy from your church because he played soccer. And they were like, yeah. And they were like, you just don't understand. And they went on to recount how, you know, most of us that have been converted from a life of drunkenness and fighting and prostitution and everything else, and where we used to get into all that stuff was at the soccer games, because you'd go there and play or watch soccer and drink, and then you'd get into fights, and then you'd go out with and womanize and so on and so forth. And so, in their minds, soccer was associated with all these evil things, so much so that they had, you remember our discussion a couple of weeks ago about the two circles, and the inner circle, some of them didn't feel free to go to soccer, so they had just made that an arbitrary absolute, and they had just made it like anyone that goes to soccer is going to get kicked out of this church. It was hot down there, too. Very hot. Sizzling hot. It's right on the equator. And it was really bizarre to see the women coming into these meetings with long sleeves on. And someone said, one of the gals, in fact, that was one of our gals working down there, pointed out the women down here are not allowed to have bare arms because that's considered, you know, that makes the brothers lust for them too much. So think about it. Here was a church, a fundamentalist group, living in a culture that was centered on soccer and was in like one of the real hot parts of the world. And to be a Christian, you never can go to soccer or play it. And if you're a woman, you got to wear long sleeves. That's great. That's just great. That's what you call anti-cultural fundamentalism. You know, we said these guys are so horny that they can't look at a woman's bare arm without losing it. Yeah, maybe you should just put in a cold shower out and back here or something. It's pitiful. The Christians there were convinced, though, that this was God's way, and they would have felt bothered in their conscience if they had gone against this. What a terrific barrier that was to the gospel in that area. Cambodia, I'll show a movie on this.
Out at the Bible school, we met this guy named Zay Bontom, and he asked if I'd come to his church and preach, so I agreed. When we got there, he was teaching Sunday school, so there weren't very many people there. They met in the empty building vacated by the Bible school recently. The 400-square-foot room opened onto the street. Bypassers could see what was going on. Pretty soon it was time for church, and more people started coming. I'd say about 60 or 70 by the time they got done. They had a program that we looked at in Cambodian, but there was also a page in English. And we were very disappointed to see that the whole service was utterly Western. Obviously, they didn't dream this up. This is what they were taught. They had a gal read the scripture I was going to teach on, which was the feeding of the 5,000. Next, they had the chorus line get up and lead singing. They had a generator there so they could use electric keyboards. Everyone that got up front that day had the same uniform on, white tops and navy blue skirt or pants. Next, they clapped hands, sang, and walked around greeting each other with the Cambodian praying hands and bow from the waist. I had to drop the camera so I could bow back. Next came the children's choir. Also very Western. Finally, it was my turn.
Think about this boy. It was not a scholar, like say.
I got on that in that brand new next lap, don't know.
It was just a boy.
What about you coming from boy now?
Why could such a boy feed so many people? Not because he had a lot.
But man had broke.
Because what he did have, he put in the hands of Jesus.
But that way, he got me to.
Don't tell God I'm too small.
Sống cùng ông đây.
Don't tell God I have no education.
Cùng tên pra quang quá cùng cùng ông.
Don't tell God I'm too poor.
Cùng ông pra quang nhà quá cùng cùng cro nè.
Tell God I put myself in your hands.
Bên sông lục nhẹ từ.
Well, that was kind of the heart of the message anyway. I guess they liked it. At least nobody complained. After church, we decided to go out and check out one of the Cambodian street markets. As we checked out the market, I reflected on the groups we'd been seeing and what was happening spiritually in Cambodia. According to our reading, there has been as few as 20 churches in Cambodia at the time Pol Pot took over. 90% were killed by Pol Pot. Pastor Bontom said that today there are 700 churches in Cambodia. Of course, most of these groups are house churches, 20 people or so it's a pretty small number when you consider 10 or 11 million people in the country. On the other hand, the group that he had has only been there for a few months, and they've won 60 or 70. Pretty much everywhere we went, people were having no trouble reaching Khmers and planting churches. It seemed clear that the Khmer people are very responsive to the gospel compared to other unreached groups.
Same thing. It was interesting going to a Cambodian church in Phnom Penh. Here is a country with less than a tenth of 1% Christian in this country. They are such a non-Christian country. So we go, and there are a few little churches starting up. This one guy had started a church, and he had 60 or 70 people coming out to it. We went to it. He wanted me to come and speak there. So I went there, and I was sitting, and it was amazing to see. First of all, they started playing the music. I couldn't understand the words, but you could immediately recognize it as Christian church music. You know, it just had that sound. They had brought in a generator so that they could have a keyboard there to play Western-style music, whereas Cambodian music doesn't use keyboards at all. And then they would get people up in their blue and white uniforms, and they had the kids up doing the hand signal type singing like you see in church sometimes today, and stuff like that. They had an order of worship that could have come out of any church, because they had it in Cambodian and English, so it could have come out of any church here in America. And it was just amazing to see here in Christianity going into another culture, it's refused to change clothes into Cambodian clothing. It's still wearing Western clothing. And this is a Western style church. And it was very upsetting to me, that the Christians were bringing Western Christianity into an Eastern culture like that. That's not supposed to happen. We also went to another group that met in somebody's hut on the mat, circle sitting on the floor, which is the way the Cambodians meet socially. And they had a Cambodian style fellowship. So, I mean, it was possible, and it was certainly something that could be done. But a lot of people don't realize the importance of contextualizing the gospel. USA, well, we have tons of problems here, tons of problems with this. I watch the advertisements coming on the TV nowadays for some music CD of worship music. And a lot of people really like the worship music. I don't particularly like music, but the thing is, I listen to it, and when I go often to fellow Christians' conferences and so forth and churches to visit, they always talk about worship music a lot. And one of the things you realize is that they don't realize that Christian music has a specific cultural sound totally different than any other type or genre of music that you could listen to in our culture today. You could turn on the radio and listen and scan the dial from end to end and never hear anything quite like it. Christianity has formed a musical subculture of its own specialized music. And whether you like that music or not, you know, what I'm pointing to is not to say that it's bad music. I'm saying that it's different. It's different than what our culture listens to. And so we find that there is a subculture growing up there. We find that a lot of the most popular things in our culture, you know, I'm a guy, so speaking about it from a guy perspective, one of the things that guys in our culture really like to do is like maybe get together on a Sunday afternoon, pass out cold beers, and sit and watch a football game. That's a big cultural thing in our country. People do that. And in many, you know, Western churches, that would be against their rules to do that. You couldn't do that. So you could not go out to a nightclub and listen to an act or go out dancing with your wife either, because that would be against the rules. Even though these are some, you could not, if you go down to the Lenox Theater down here on a Saturday night, you may have to drive around for 45 minutes to find a parking lot in this ocean-sized parking lot, because there are tens of thousands of people there. You realize this has got to be, what are there, 38 theaters there? This has got to be the most popular thing happening in our culture. You know, one of the very top things happening is cinema. And many churches in our country would have a rule against going to almost all of those movies, maybe all of them. That's anti-cultural fundamentalism. That's a Christianity that has failed to adapt itself to the context of its own culture. And the result is that the message comes out loud and clear to everyone in that culture: you can come to Christ, you're welcome to come to our church, but you're going to have to utterly change your culture if you do. And this becomes cultural baggage, which has been attached to the gospel. Cultural prejudices, of which there are many, should be refuted by the Christian church. Here's where we should resist our culture. There's some areas we should conform, and there's other areas we should resist. You know, for instance, in Exer culture, and I work with students a lot, the under 30 crowd, very segmented and very prejudiced against each other. You have, you know, punk rockers, and then you have other guys from the city schools listen to rap, and then there's some people that are into indie rock. And these groups hate each other. They have absolute contempt, a remarkable level of contempt for people. You know, you listen to the punk rockers. I've got one of my kids is into that. And the scorn that he has for people who listen to, you know, mainstream music or rap music and so forth is really kind of pitiful. So the Bible says, though, that Jesus is for all cultures. And we have to basically be able to move into all of these subcultures that exist within our culture, and to do it as rappers, as punks, as indie rockers, and so on. Home churches are an excellent opportunity to practice contextualization, because each home church can have its own cultural flavor. You could go to home churches here where you could walk in and there would be some hoodlums hanging around, a lot of people with piercings and tattoos, a cigarette hanging out of their mouth, and, you know, they'd look up at you like, what's your problem? And there's just a real attitude there, and they all got their Bibles out, and they're really moving into, you know, excited about Christ. I've been to other home churches here where they sit in rows and have song leaders get up and hold up the things while they play their songs, and then they have an announcement person get up, and then they have the speaker get up, and it's like very formalized. I'm sitting there thinking, you know, this wouldn't work in my home church. But it's a different context. And so each home church has the opportunity to develop a different contextual slant, and they should do that for the sake of the people in their field of ministry. So we have to ask ourselves, are you able to come out of your cultural context? If that's what it took for you to bring the gospel to somebody that needed it, would you be able to discomfort yourself to such an extent that you could go into a culture that you find alien to you And it is painful. I'm involved also in a high school cell group where they're all punk rock. Everyone in that cell is into punk rock. And I loathe punk rock. I cannot stand punk rock. I've tried and tried. I can't find even one piece that I really like. So, you know, when I go in there, it's kind of like, you know, I gotta hold my breath culturally that whole night just to survive being with those guys and try not to make too many snide comments and stuff about their music. The problem that we're talking about is called cultural containment. That's what we're trying to avoid. John Stott says the greatest tendency of the church throughout its long and checkered history has been its constant tendency to conform to the prevailing culture instead of developing a Christian counterculture. You know, that's true, but I think it's actually even worse than what he's saying. Because we conform to one culture, and we're not willing to be countercultural to that culture, but then we are countercultural to other cultures. Let me put it this way. And when we think of culture, what makes up culture? The religious beliefs of a group, their prejudices, their mythology, their dress, their music and their art, their language and their recreational habits. Those are the types of things that are kind of lumped together and called this is what a culture is. And I'm suggesting to you that what we're called to is we're to be countercultural in some ways, but pro-cultural in other ways. When it comes to religious beliefs, prejudices, and mythology, we should be countercultural. Because the things that our culture believes and the prejudices they have and their mythology are false. And so we should oppose that part in favor of the truth. But when it comes to the dress, the music, and the art, the language of our culture, and the recreational habits of our culture, that's where we should be pro-cultural. Like Paul, this is what he's saying. When I'm with the Greeks, I'm like I'm a Greek. When I'm with the Jews, I'm like I'm a Jew. I conform as much as possible in those areas. But not that he would conform to Greek culture to the extent of becoming an idol worshiper, right? That would be their religious beliefs. It doesn't conform to that part. Conforms to the other part. But what we see often in the history of Christianity is actually the reverse of this. Where we are pro-cultural when it comes to religious beliefs, prejudices, and mythology, and counterculture when it comes to the innocuous and harmless aspects of culture like dress, music, art, and recreation. Both of these, of course, are flat wrong. Religious beliefs. Historians are pretty unanimous in saying that when Christianity penetrated Europe, Europeans were polytheistic and animistic. They were used to praying to many gods, and they were used to also praying to goddesses. And this was the genesis of the practice of praying to saints, and also of Mariology, neither one of which finds any warrant in the Bible whatsoever, neither one of which existed in the early church, but which developed as they moved into pagan Europe and accommodated themselves religiously to the groups there. In Latin America also, when Christianity went in there, it accommodated itself to shamanism and animistic healing practices to where today, in many areas, anthropologists refer to the religion of whole regions there as being Christo-pagan, which is paganism with Jesus Christ inserted in some ways. So the shaman will, you know, shake his rattle and pronounce his incantation for healing, and then he'll wave a cross over the wound. Something I've personally seen done before. And it's like, here's the crucifix, here's the rattle. You know, we'll just use whatever we can, but it's like it's become syncretism. They've mixed it all together. They failed to be countercultural when it came to the religious beliefs of the culture. We think of the prejudices of the culture. A lot of people don't know, for instance, that many of the churches in the U.S. divided North and South. Why is it that there's an American Baptist and a Southern Baptist? You know that? It's because at the time of the Civil War, the Southern Baptists divided from the American Baptists because they were pro-slavery. Oh, yeah. In fact, this happened in one denomination after the other, right down the Mason-Dixon line, until it became very clear that, you know, what mattered in your view about slavery was not anything to do with the Bible, but where you live geographically. They completely, like chameleons, adapted to that culture. Today we find that this is still true. I went to a church as a youth where they believed and taught that it would be a sin for a white person to marry a black person. They believed that. Even at the time, we used to get a kick out of challenging them and saying, where does it say that in the Bible and stuff? And, you know, there's no biblical warrant for any belief like that, but there are many Christians today who still believe that on a religious basis. They've accepted prejudices from our culture. Actually, the church has been strangely silent when it comes to race throughout the last 100 years. And not the black church, but the white church has been strangely silent on this point. So they've been pro-cultural where they should have been countercultural. We think of the mythology of a culture. Most cultures in the world, the majority, I would say, at least the ones I've studied, believe that they are the greatest culture in the world and that their country is the center of the world. In most of these countries, their religion affirms that, and part and parcel of their religion is the worship of their own culture. You know, that's what Hinduism is. It's Indian culture. I've listened to Hindu scholars talk and say that's basically, you can't describe the doctrines of Hinduism because it's just basically Hindu culture. But they're worshiping their own culture. And in many cases, cultures have stories about how this culture and language is given to us by the gods. And that's why we're this way. And the religion backs that up. We have it in America, too. And today we find much of American fundamentalism eagerly buying into mythology about the United States being God's country, being founded by God and for God, being, you know, like one of the real righteous countries in the world, completely overlooking everything or downplaying everything to the contrary of that. And it's actually a fetish with many Christians today to get into right-wing politics and think and talk about how Christian and glorious this country is. They're buying into the mythology of our own culture. There are like a lot of great things about our country, mostly that we're extremely fortunate. And a lot of that fortune has come at the expense of people that we wiped out who were here before us. I wouldn't say it's of God. I think we have it good. I think we have it really good, but I wouldn't say that that's necessarily that God has brought us to that point. See, we want to mix our religion in and become pro-cultural in our mythology. We think of dress. Christians have fought the dress of our culture as they still do today. In church after church, like you see churches here in town, I get this from the students that I work with, how their church has been persecuting because they got like a nose bone in their nose or something. You know, and I mean, that stuff, the piercing and all that gives me the willies. But it's really, it's an external cultural issue of dress. And we have right here in our own fellowship, I have heard of parents battling their own children and even alienating themselves from their kids because of the kids came home with orange hair or pierced something or whatever. Folks, why are we fighting? That's exactly what happened 30 years ago when I was a kid, is that our church took a cultural stand and said that men wearing long hair was against the Bible. In spite of the fact that Jesus Christ undoubtedly had long hair compared to our standards today. Now, they considered it short hair because it was cut, you know. But the church has a history of this, and it's such a mistake. We think of music and art. The church in America has battled every new trend in music and art that has come along. I remember my grandparents refusing to watch, and they were fundamentalists, they refused to watch Lawrence Welk anymore because he was getting too, quote, jazzy, and they were against jazz. They felt that jazz was sinful. And they had brought in this blonde bouffant woman who played boogie-woogie on the piano, and they just thought that was just, oh. Well, you can imagine, you know, we had at my house with my parents, we had record burnings and breakings and everything else. And when we showed up with Hendrix and Zeppelin and stuff like that, we had to hide everything that we had or it would have been broken and shattered. And so it has been and it continues to be right up to the present day. language, the church tends to form its own linguistic subgroup and develops their own way of talking. The church is so uptight about profanity and loose language today. I remember sitting under, when I went to the Reformed church, at one point we were in a Reformed church, and the preacher there was obsessed with people saying golly, gosh, or gee whiz, and things like that, because he's like, if you say gosh, you know, what you really mean is God. I mean, it's like, and people say gee whiz, that's really Jesus Christ. And they're just trying to keep from swearing. And so, is that really right, you know, to do that? And he would get into these things with our youth group, and we just used to be like, give them a break. But Christians are just so fussy about this, and they wind up talking and acting completely different than the culture of which they're a part. Recreation, we already talked about, the things with cinema and so on and so forth. This is wrong. We should be exactly the opposite. Counterculture when it comes to religious beliefs, because our culture believes that there is no truth, that anything you believe is true for you. That's something we have to oppose and say, no, as a matter of fact, that's a dangerous belief, and there is a God, Lord God, Creator out there who is as real as can be, and it doesn't matter what you think about him, because he's there. The prejudices, we should be fighting against the prejudice. We should have had the leading voice, and some Christians did, in all fairness, fight against the race prejudice, for example, in our culture. They led the fight in that. Very few, unfortunately. The mythology, we should be actively rejecting the false mythology of our own culture. We should be studying how people dress and behave in the field of ministry of which we're a part. And in modern culture, we find that culture is stratified into subcultures that are quite different from one another. So we have to fit in with a particular subculture of which we're a part. We should be proficient in the music, art, cinema of the culture that we're reaching, even if we don't like it. We should listen to it, study it, learn the lyrics, find out what they're saying and the attitudes are. That's a crucial part of identifying with your culture. Learning to talk the way they talk, learning to do recreation the way they do, and that should all be incorporated into the church. Denying ourselves our right to have our own culture, denying that right for the sake of other people who don't want to have to change their culture in order to hear the gospel. It's a very important principle. I have become all things to all men that I might by all means reach some. That's what Paul did. We should do that too. All right, we'll draw the line there. Next week, we're going to open up the books on a very controversial and exciting topic of Paul and women. A lot of people feel that Paul had a bad attitude about women, that he was male dominant. We'll see about that next week. All right, so here we are over here.
I've been listening to rap, and that's pretty doggone gross. But I was wondering if you could comment about, you know, how there's got to be a moral line you draw, or a line that you don't cross. And I was wondering if you could make some general comment about some kind of parameters, because you could jump into that hip-hop culture and say la me. I mean, it's, yeah, those lyrics are pretty...
I think we should be as liberal as possible, because, first of all, listening to somebody talking about evil and doing something evil are completely different things. And, you know, I think of some of the lyrics that I used to listen to, and I still listen to it, and Led Zeppelin music, for instance, is as raw as anything that the rappers have ever said. I've also listened to music that was about, I'm going to kill you, you know, somebody's getting all violent, I'm going to go out and kill. It's never given me any impulse to kill anyone. I've never had the slightest urge to do that. I think we look back. What about Frank Sinatra's song, I Did It My Way? Biblically, it's a very wicked lyric. You know, that he went through his life and all he did was he did everything the way he wanted and deferred to no one and nobody. And yet, who would be afraid, really, to listen to that song? That's not going to infect us. And I think what we have to think about I think this is analogous to the meat sacrifice to idols thing. I think it's like that. The hardliners in Rome felt that they could never eat that meat because it would defile them, because it had to do with idol worship. Paul was saying, it isn't going to have that effect unless you think it will. You know, when you pump it up and make it a big deal, then it will have that effect. But the truth is, we can't, if we're worried about hearing something dirty, if we're worried about hearing something violent, then we have to completely exit our own culture in order to get away from that stuff. You really can't get away from it. You'd have to turn off your television, for instance. And what we find is, we find that parents that are restricting their kids' access to mainstream rap, rock, punk, all of this stuff, are having zero effect, absolutely zero effect, in resisting their children's move in the direction of evil. That the main effect is to create bitterness on the part of kids at their parents and their parents' religion, which is dictating that they have to be so different than their friends. It does absolutely no good. It poisons the relationship that you need to cultivate with your kids in order to have the closeness so that you can influence them. And I'm worried about this. In our church, I'm not talking about the fundamentalist church now, I'm talking about this church, where we see this happening because I work with the kids, and I'm hearing Xenos kids say to me, "I hate my dad and my mom." And I know that their dad and mom and their home church leaders here. I talk to them, you know, why do you hate them? They're so restricted. They're not letting me do this. And it's a lot of cultural stuff where they're being, I think, unnecessarily restrictive. And thinking that they're protecting and keeping their kid away from evil, I'd like to put this proposition to you. How much effect do you think you're going to have on your 17-year-old son when he's out with a hot girl from high school and thinking to himself, "I'd really like to have sex with this hot girl, but I know that that would displease my father, who I hate." Okay? Are you with me? First things first here. I worry about some of the lyrics and cinema and stuff that my kids see, but not to where I'm going to poison my relationship with them. I would rather go with them and listen to it together and point out what's being said and critique it. That's the way to do that.
Take us out of the student culture into the culture most of us are in here. So now I'm in a situation where people are going out to $100 dinners and buying $50 bottles of wine, driving $50,000 cars. Maybe I need to change my spending habits.
I think what we have to do is, again, what Paul would have done, he would have gone as far as possible in the direction of being compatible with that type of affluent culture without engaging in something that would be actually morally wrong. So we have to think to ourselves on the issue of stewardship, where do I think I should spend my money? And I've been in this situation too when we've been reaching out to some people that were extremely wealthy, and we felt led by God to live a simple life, and we didn't want to live a wealthy life. And so it was difficult. You know, I mean, we can always wear appropriate clothing and we can go places, but there is a tension there when a moral component comes in that we feel like, you know, the money I have was given to me by God, I need to have a stewardship for it, and then I don't want to waste it all just to show that I too can be affluent. And I think that does become kind of a moral dilemma at that point, which is a matter of conscience, and I think that individuals would have to decide where they're going to fall on that, you know, how far they're prepared to go there. But we have to be prepared to go part of the way, at least. Okay, one more over here.
I recall another apostle who, on the surface anyway, seemed like he was into contextualization, and Paul chewed him out for it. And that was Peter. He was with the Gentiles, acting like a Gentile, and then with the Jews like a Jew, and Paul called him out publicly over that. How's that different than Paul's approach?
In Peter's situation, both cultures were present. And Peter snubbed the Gentile culture in favor of the Jewish culture. Paul also reveals that Peter did this not because of any kind of settled consideration that this would be for the furtherance of the gospel, but because he was intimidated and afraid of being judged by these guys. So it was done on a selfish basis rather than... Here's one other consideration, too. When Paul talks about extending ourselves into other cultural frameworks, this is for the sake of people who need to know about Christ. Whereas the hardline Jewish guys that came down in that situation were already believers. So there was no need to culturally adapt to them, because they already had the Lord. It was those others in Antioch, the thousands of Gentiles that were being reached, they needed to be adapting to their culture. And actually, that whole episode probably made outreach very difficult in that city when they saw all the Christians acting aloof from Gentiles. So to adapt to a culture is done for young believers, weak believers, or non-believers, not for older believers who, for instance, I used to have, when I was a smoker, I used to have sometimes an older Christian would come up to me and say, you know, you stumble me because you smoke. And I'd be like, you're kidding, you want to smoke too? And they'd be like, no, I don't want to smoke. It just stumbles me. Oh, you mean you're offended. You're not tempted to smoke. You're just offended that someone would smoke. That's not what we're talking about. What would Romans 14 say to them at that point? They would say, why do you judge your brother, right? When we talk about stumbling the weaker brother, we're talking about somebody being unable to come to Christ. That's what this passage is anyway. Okay, we're out of time. Why don't we turn to the Lord? Heavenly Father, what a really complex area, but it's an exciting area to think about too. That we have the opportunity given to us by Christ to practice real love for other people. And that does mean giving up rights that we have and freedoms that we have at times. And I pray, God, that you'll give us the courage and the heart to do that. That we won't hesitate to come outside of what makes us comfortable and be willing to meet people in a context that makes them feel comfortable. That's certainly an important part of the sacrificial love you want us to practice. I pray to God, I pray for our kids, that we can show them these same principles and that they will be a part of their culture, not separate from it. And a part of it in the cultural sense, but not in the moral sense, Lord, that they also know how to be countercultural when it comes to what's true and what is right and what's wrong. It's not easy for us to function in this fluid situation, Lord. But we thank you for giving us the principles that we need. And we thank you in Christ's name. Amen.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.